Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Bonnie Joy Kaslan, Honorary Consul General for Turkey in the San Francisco Bay Area, your moderator for today's program. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Carol Bertram was a Fulbright Scholar to Turkey and is now an associate professor in the Department of Humanities and Faculty in Middle East and Islamic Studies at San Francisco State University. She received her MA in Near Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley and her PhD in Art and Architectural History with a focus in the pre-modern and early modern Middle East at UCLA. Her book, Imagining the Turkish House, Collective Visions of Home, shows how Ottoman and Turkish houses became objects of memory, carrying personal and political meanings through periods of radical change. Dr. Bertram's particular interests are in the poetics of space, that is, how spaces are not only built, but felt, and in the richness and diversity of Islamic culture. Dr. Bertram is preparing a book on the transformative experience of homesick tourism, the journeys of return made by people whose histories include traumatic exile and the loss of home. This includes Palestinian loss in Israel, Palestine, Jewish loss in Arab countries, Greek loss in Turkey, and vice versa, each of which is particularly relevant because of the memory crisis felt by all groups. Dr. Carol is presently organizing a field study trip in Turkey where students can begin to study the Turkish language while investigating both the Ottoman and current Turkish history and current culture through the lens of the humanities. Please welcome Dr. Carol Bertram.
Thank you, Bonnie. Can you hear me? Yes? Yes. Thank you, Bonnie, for this nice introduction. And I'm louder? Is that a yes? No. Okay. So thank you for the nice introduction. And it's always wonderful when somebody says that you're about to write a book because you think, oh, my God, I better run home and get on that. And thank you, Celia Menzel, too, for inviting me. I was thrilled when she contacted me and said she had read my book. I said, you read my book? It's so esoteric. I wrote it for myself. I didn't really think of it as something that would kind of go into anyone's hand. But she had read it. I was thrilled. And she asked me to come and speak to the Middle East Forum. And I'm so happy to be here. Thank you all. Now, I'm going to try and not have to be on my toes for this. So I'm going to talk to you today about the Ottoman house. And when I'm doing that, what I'm really talking about, of course, is some of what is inside my book. But I'll speak about it as part of my interest and my research. So I'm going to talk to you today about this old Ottoman house and about the new Turk who came to remember this house as his or her place of origins. So I'm going to show this old house that no longer was being built in Turkey, but how it entered memory through paintings, through buildings, through descriptions, especially descriptions, and stories that take place in these old houses in novels, as well as poetry. So I'm going to talk about the images of the house, the houses that were created in people's minds, created in people's imaginations, or called forth in their imaginations as a way to bring the past into the present. So actually, along with Turkish houses, I will be talking about how images operate as sites of memory, and how images are asked to carry specific cultural information and to perform very specific cultural services. In fact, what I'm going to do is ask what services was this house asked to perform, and then I'm going to ask whether or not the house was willing to go along with the deal that was made for it. So here is the Ottoman house, what came to be called a Turkish house. As I said, a house that was never built in the country that we today call Turkey because it was built in a different time. It was built in Ottoman time, and it was built in a different place, the Ottoman Empire. As you may know, or you will certainly know very soon, it has a very special look to it. It is a timber house and often half-timbered house. The living quarters are on the upper floors. It is protected by overhanging eaves, and the living quarters that are upstairs jut out over the street to make use of the free area of the street, the part you don't have to pay for by buying land. And it also had regular windows. They are all from the same guild, so you order them. It's kind of like, it gives a homogeneity to the street the way that Home Depot or IKEA gives a certain homogeneity to some of our houses. And inside, you can see these windowed walls where people would sit during the day, and in my own romantic imagination, they're sitting there drinking coffee. But they are looking out, taking advantage of the breezes and the light during the day. So it's this, the overhanging eaves and the rooms and the windows that gave the Ottoman house a distinctive profile, and it also defined the Ottoman street and the Ottoman town. And it was built wherever the Ottomans went. So it exists in Sarajevo, in Istanbul, in Amasya, where I did much of my Fulbright work, a gorgeous town, in Damascus, and of course all over the Ottoman world. There is, of course, no more Ottoman world, no more Ottoman Empire. But in the Turkish imagination today, the Ottoman house appears in many forms and in many places. Here you can see it as a gated community. I actually have friends who shamelessly live here. Very expensive, and when you go inside, of course, they're quite modern. But these are not Ottoman houses. These are representations of what I called, what I like to call, an imaginary landscape. Here's another imaginary landscape. It's a drawing of a neighborhood of Ottoman-style houses. It was drawn by a junior high school student in Istanbul in 1991. You'll notice the 1990s appearing in my talk because that's when I was doing my research in Turkey in 94, 95, and 96. So I was making use of materials that were from that period. So she had won this contest, and the contest was for Turkish students to draw or paint their ideal city or their ideal world. Her world is an Ottoman world, and perhaps you recognize the spot in Ortaköy. There is the Ortaköy Mosque and the bridge, but if you are familiar with this area, you know that it is not filled with these adorable little chalet Ottoman houses. In fact, the houses that are still there are quite deteriorated, and most of the area is now concrete. So it's a memory image from someone else's memory. And I ask in my work, how did it come into the memory of the 20th and the 21st century? Here's another memory image that brings the Ottoman house into the present. It's a cartoon that I randomly ran across in 1996. And you see a wooden house against a very modern 20th century skyline. From the outside, it's clear that it's not inhabited. It's in the same state as most of the old houses were in 1996. And an old man is standing, of course, I'm redefining my definition of old as we go, but I think this was meant to be an old man standing in front of it, and he's saying to himself, oh yeah, this is the place where I lived as a child. But no one could live there now, just look at the roof. Nonetheless, he goes up to the door, and it opens, and lo and behold, a beautiful young woman in Ottoman dress, so an Ottoman woman, opens the door, and of course he's shocked, and he says, geez, she's gorgeous, or something like that. So he's invited in, and the house still offers to him a Ottoman hospitality. He's invited into one of those rooms overlooking the street, and he's offered some coffee. But the artist makes it really clear that this experience is a hallucination, because the walls are coming alive for him as he walks past them, but not for her. But is this really his old Ottoman life? Clearly, and as I tell my students, whenever I use the word clearly, it means she doesn't know what she's talking about, but or you need some evidence for this. But clearly, this cartoon is not autobiographical, because it can only give the illusion of memory. An old man in 1996 could never have lived this 18th century rendition of Ottoman life as a child. And not only that, when you really stop to think about it, and I did, the memory that this house portrays is not his memory. It's the memory of the young cartoonist. These old houses, as I said, have not been built since the end of the Ottoman Empire. And today, those that have not succumbed to fire or replacement by concrete have not been lived in with an Ottoman lifestyle for well over 100 years. But the cartoon drawing and the gated community are evidence that the house is alive in the Turkish imagination and has been for a long time. My project was to ask why and how this happened. What I found was that this image started to appear just as the Ottoman Empire began to disappear and as these houses stopped being built. It was a time of rising national consciousness and the time of World War I, which changed everyone's identity. Ottoman Jews, Ottoman Christians, Ottoman Muslims, Greeks, Albanians, Bulgarians, Bosnians began to close ranks and come up with their own countries, with Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, Bosnia, even a small Armenia. You might think, then, that modern Turkey was a sort of rump Ottoman Empire. After everyone left, you get Turkey, full of Turks. But that isn't the case at all. As the empire was exploded into national identities, the idea of Turk was the newest one. Most Ottoman Muslims had considered themselves just that. They were Ottomans or they were Muslim. So unlike Greeks, Armenians, and Albanians, the fragmenting empire had caused a severe identity crisis, and inventing what it meant to be a Turk became the subject of intense intellectual and political debate. It's in this period of rupture and pain that the old Ottoman house began to emerge as a concept rather than just a place to hang your fez. The inspiration for this process, in part, came from the artistic instincts of the painter and teacher Hoca Ali Rıza Bey. He began to paint the neighborhoods that were disappearing, his own neighborhoods, and he taught his students to do the same thing. He taught them to see, and the house came into focus for them. In 1911, the intelligentsia, who had studied with Hoca Ali Riza Bey, formed what they call the Turkish Hearth Society, a group that would become the new ideological arm of Turkey. Its president, Hamdullah Supi, took up the idea of the house in a series of talks and articles which he entitled The Turkish House. So here, among national elites, he managed to give the Ottoman House a new name and make it into a site of memory. What he said in his speeches are things like this. How did you feel when you left your old houses, assuming that everyone in the audience had left their old houses? Were you sad when you grew up and moved away, assuming that they moved away if they had moved from one of those houses? But most of the people in the audience, probably all of them, didn't live in those houses anymore, but perhaps their families had. Probably some of their families had. And so it called forth in them an attachment to the house that was hereditary, genealogical. This house was theirs. None of them, however, Hamdullah Supi included, wanted to move back into these houses. These old houses were full of mice. No one wanted to live there. They wanted to stay in the new concrete apartments, which, by the way, were pretty lovely in the 1920s. But Hamdullah Supi had an idea. What he wanted to do was to persuade his audience of New Turks that they had a common past. And for this past, he gave them a common symbol, the wooden house. He made it seem obvious, even natural, that they or their grandparents had lived in it and somehow had lived in it together in their Turkish past. So it belonged to everyone. But what this old house would mean, I think I'm ahead of myself, was still up for grabs. Here we go. It was Mustafa Kemal Atatürk who rescued Anatolia from all those other nations who wanted it. He led the new Republic of Turkey that was established in 1923, and he made sure that the new Turkey would be consciously and carefully and finally torn from its past. It would be modern Turkish, not old Ottoman. This was going to cause a bit of a problem for our old house. The Sultan, who had also been a leader of Islam, was gone. A secular president had arrived. And by law, his instigated law, the old fez and old forms of dress were outlawed. People died for wearing a fez. Talk about a hat to die for. Women took off their scarves, religious institutions were closed, the Arabic alphabet that had been so closely tied and aligned with Islam and with the Quran was replaced by the Roman alphabet, a clear way to cut people from their past. Turkey was to be secular and Western by law, and the memory of the Ottoman Empire would be closely supervised. Into this new symbolic universe enters the old Ottoman house, now renamed the Turkish House by Hamdullah Supi and the intelligentsia, where it was to become an official site of memory. It was to become a sign of modernity. Now, this is a pretty neat trick. How did they do it? To do it, they started a new architectural style that made the old house's parts part of a new idea. They used the overhanging eaves. They used the modular windows. They used the overhanging rooms as an attempt to define an architectural style that spoke to the people.
In other words, the Turkish house was to be a sign of the past that had forgotten its Ottoman past. It had even forgotten that it was a house. But had the real house really forgotten? What I found was that the Turkish house didn't accept its role as a sign of the new Turk without a past. Instead, it decided it wanted to become a memory site in which the new Turk could find or negotiate or reimagine himself not quite so cut off from his old universe. I found this message, obviously not in the Second National style, I found it when I accepted the invitation of the novel to enter this house. Inside the closed covers of the novel, another story takes place. So let me invite you into one of the novels that you would read about in my book. This one is called Fatih Harbiye. It was published in 1931 by a well-known author and nationalist, Peyami Safa, who was born in 1899 and died in 1961. Fatih and Harbiye are two areas of Istanbul. They are on opposite sides of the Golden Horn. Fatih is a neighborhood in the heart of Istanbul's old district. In the 1920s and 30s, and even today, it is a symbol of the religious and cultural heritage of the East. So the word Fatih then and now resonated with an older time. On the opposite side of the Golden Horn, at the other end of a tram line, and what you're seeing here is the tram map, which I have drawn, is Beyoğlu, or Harbiye. And those names resonated too. They had been the stronghold of Westerners and Western ideas starting in Byzantine times. And if you go to Istanbul, I bet you stay on this side. So this was a symbol of non-Muslim and the West. The heroine of this story, Neriman, lived in Fatih. She was about 17 at the time of this story. And I think the house, too, is part of this, is a heroine in this story. She was raised by her widowed father, Faiz Bey. And the house may have been starting to fall apart, but it was described with warmth as a place where anyone could be happy. When the front door closed, the old house shook and its window panes rattled. Neriman plays the oud, which is like a lute. And in fact, she is a student at the Modern Conservatory, Music Conservatory in Istanbul, and she's dressed in Western clothing. This is, in fact, a picture of the Music Institute with a student playing the lute, but I, as you will see, have put in stand-in photographs to help you imagine. So I'm adding another layer of imagination. Her father, Faiz Bey, who is actually the great uncle of a friend of mine in Turkey, the photograph is, spends his evenings reading the great Ottoman philosophers and Ottoman poetry and history. Neriman's sweetheart, Shinasi, is also from Fatih, and he's also a musician, and he studies at the conservatory. He, too, plays a traditional Turkish instrument, the kemenci. Islam and religion are never mentioned in this novel. That would go against political Kemalism, Mustafa Kemal's ideas and laws that made sure that only the secular were part of the public voice. No Turkish music, no religious music was allowed at that time to be on the radio, for example, although we know that Atatürk at home only listened to Turkish music. So in the novel, codes are used. For example, as I said, Neriman's father likes to read mystical poetry along with philosophy and history. These are codes for his attachment to the Ottoman world. The musical instruments that are played by Neriman and Shinasi do the same thing. In fact, it's clear that if Neriman and Shinasi, these two kids who are tied to a classical past by their houses and their music, if these two would only marry, Modern life would go on, but with the old values still intact. Alas, Nariman is attracted by the lights of Harbiya, and she takes the tram there, the Fatih Harbiya tram. And the novel is really about what might happen if this were a one-way trip. She goes to sit in the cafes of Harbiya on Istiklal Jadisi, the Grand Rue de Pera. She gives up playing the oud. It's too out of date. It's too Eastern. And not only does she give up playing the oud, but God forbid, she starts to play the violin. She even dreams of going to a dress ball. This was a period when people were writing about hat and ball longings, the desire to wear a hat instead of a scarf and to go to dances. But each time Nariman would return from Harbiya, it got really worse for her. The houses of Fatih seemed darker and more sleepy and more silent. The silent is appropriate because my pages just went out of order. I had this happen once in a lecture. All my slides were out of order, and so I said, well, what I will do is just change the my conclusion. Well, I don't seem to have those, so we'll just go ahead. So she came back, and everything was as it had been. It seemed really dark, so different from the lights of Beyoğlu. Her father, Faiz Bey, saw this as what it was, a spiritual crisis. And so he tried to explain to her that the houses of Fatih, with their gas lamp lighting, had inside of them a deep wisdom from the East that was unlike the materialism of the West, and that this could be her heritage. But it didn't work. Of course, those of you who are parents know that these little talks often don't help, and Nariman continued to go back to Fatih. However, one day, she was walking with her sweetheart, Shinasi, in the old part of Fatih, and they had done that a lot. They would walk by these old houses on the way to the conservatory, and when they were going, there was an old house that they always passed, and they made up stories about it, kind of ghost stories. Maybe you've done that too. And they saw this old house, and they said, it's described in the book, the windows had lost their rectangularity, the eaves had lost some of their planks, the zinc cladding had fallen in. This huge house was in such ruins that even a 3-year-old child could push it down. But, they noticed, there were still curtains on the windows. So, was anyone inside? And if so, who? This was what led to their imagination. So they imagined that there was a man there. He had a long white beard. The cap that he put on his bald head was plain and simple. He sat by the right-hand window and fiddled with his prayer beads, his lips always mumbling a prayer. He would think, but he wasn't thinking about people or work. He had large ideas about the world, about humanity, about God and death. This is what these two youngsters were imagining. Now, one day, when he heard a footstep on the street, his trembling head would look out the window behind the grills, and when he would see Nariman and Shinasi walking by, he would shut his eyes and pray that they were happy. Now, one day when Nariman came back from her trip to Harbiya, she suddenly was walking by this house, and she was caught up with a strange feeling, as if she had heard a footstep in the house. And then she thought the door opened, and she thought she saw the image of the old man on the threshold. He still had his prayer beads in his hands, but this time his face was as white as his beard and his nightcap, and he asked with eyes that tried to conceal a deep sad astonishment. What has happened, children? What happened to you? She faints, and she goes back home, and in the end of the novel, the tram does return to Fatih, and she returns to the houses, and everyone goes to sleep in the warmth of this old building, but also in the warmth of the spiritual universe that it stands for. And she returns to the Oud as well. She has introduced to the audience a new way of thinking about the Turkish house. It is now a place where people can go to renegotiate their ideas about the West and their ideas about modernity. They can maintain their modernity. In fact, Faiz Bey went out and sold some of the family jewels to make sure that his daughter could go to one of those balls so that she could have a dress for one of those balls. But it's also a place where ideas and values that were so consciously made illegal outside of the home are discussed, or if they're not discussed, they have a kind of attachment that resonates. And that's how, with these stories, I saw the house being filled with grandparents, with ghosts, with youngsters who were talking about the new Turkey that had not been so painfully severed from their past. And that gave me the new perspective over the years of things, of images that I looked at that go back to the 1920s and 30s, but also into the present, why this house is still resonating. It is still connecting to something that is perhaps harder to identify, but still felt very strongly, the old Ottoman past. I saw it in Istanbul in the late 1990s, and it's still going on today, during the time of Ramadan, the month when Muslims fast from sunrise to sunset and then have a good time in the evening. In Istanbul, in Sultan Ahmet area, there the municipality has built a street of little old Ottoman houses to connect the idea of Ramadan and Islam to this Ottoman period so that the people who are walking along these streets are actually walking back and taking their religion, their modern way of practicing Islam, back into these old houses. So I'd like to say that even though for many groups in Turkey the rupture has not yet been resolved, the Turkish house is a memory image that's quite alive. And it makes sense to look at it today and say, from the outside, it looks completely dilapidated. But inside, dear man, there are people, and everything is alive and thriving. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Carol Bertram, author of Imagining the Turkish House, for her comments. I'm Bonnie Joy Kaslan, Honorary Consul General for Turkey in the San Francisco Bay Area. I will be moderating today's audience question period. We would like to remind the listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to Imagining the Turkish House with Dr. Carol Bertram. I'll begin the question and answer period now. And I think the first question, first of all, for me, it is a particular delight to be here, as Turkey has always been my passion. And again, to see Carol after so many years of kind of going our own ways, promoting Turkey. And the first question I would like to ask is, Carol, what was the impetus that prompted you to not only write the book, but to entitle it Imagining the Turkish House?
For any of you who have written books, you will know that you don't get to choose the title. So my editors decided that it had to have the word Turkish house in it so that people could Google it. And I and all my friends had sat down and thought, well, we'd like it to be called A House Above the Street. So I always think of it as a house above the street. But they wanted the Turkish house. But the books, the Turkish house, have been written. There are many books called the Turkish house. They're mostly architecture or books that are coffee table books. So they decided imagining the Turkish house.
That would be the title.
That would be the title. And then collective visions of home. I still have a hard time remembering the title. But I think it works, you know. And they also decide on the cover as well. I think they did a good job.
Thank you. There was a question about Nariman. But you meant Nariman wears Western dress, but her head is covered indoors. Please explain.
The image that I showed you, as I said, is from the conservatory in 1918 in Istanbul. It's not really Nariman, but it is the kind of class that she would have gone to. And some of the women do have their head covered and some don't. But this is before the headscarf law. It's when people were just beginning to. But indoors, unless there was a man in the room, as you noticed, the teacher was a man. If the teacher had been a woman, people would have taken off their headscarves.
We've had two questions about, most of you realize that Turkey sits on the Anatolian Plateau, and it is subject, as is Greece, to great earthquakes. So, interesting, the question is, have earthquakes diminished the stock of traditional houses in Anatolia? And following up with that, is anything being done today to protect and preserve the old houses and buildings? Are there government assistant programs for this work?
I can't answer much about the earthquakes, but I haven't seen that it has been a problem. The major earthquake of Istanbul is 1999. It's too late. You know, the houses are mostly gone. So, no, I would say that we have to thank people for the destruction of the houses. And that relates, too, to the second question of, is there any government or municipal assistance for these houses? Yes and no. As with any government, there are ways around any kind of laws. The Turkish government has a system of protection of historical sites, including houses, and these houses fall into a layered list of types. The first one is a type of house that, if it is rebuilt, it must be built according to the actual original plans, if the plans exist, or at least according to what is known about the house, including all the original materials. The second, and I won't remember all four of them, but the second is that original materials must be used on the exterior of the house. So the house must look like the old house, and it must have at least a cladding outside, although it can be built with it can be built by concrete. And the insides can be however you want them to be. And the third would be, so there's four, but I don't remember. The third is that it can look like the shape, but it can be entirely in concrete. So what's happened in Turkey is that people can't afford to restore their houses. They don't have, not they no longer have the money to, or the lifestyle that would make it feasible to have a big house that was large enough for several generations. And therefore, they leave their houses to decay, and somebody accidentally strikes a match, and hopefully their house is one of the ones that can be replaced. Many of them are part of what is called yapsat housing, buy and build, where a contractor comes into the house, and I know many of the houses that succumb to this, and says, give me your old house. I will build on it a five-story apartment building. Five is the maximum in most towns. You are to give me one of those flats, and the rest are for you. And therefore, you have a flat for grandma and grandpa, older brother, and the family. And there's many of these. So we see that the plot is still there, but the house is gone. And that happened all over Istanbul. So today there is a vakif, which is money that is set aside for an establishment to protect old houses, but they're not having a lot of luck.
Following up with a question about Orhan Pamuk's book, Istanbul,
mm-hmm.
when the writer stumbled upon your book, wants to know whether you think his snapshot of the city rings true.
I love that book. Yes, it does. And in fact, I think, oh, I'm so glad that he wrote it because he wrote it after mine, because he doesn't take up my issues. But he brings in the writers, many of the authors and artists that I have talked about as being so important in people's minds. And so it makes it clear that the story, the backstory, the memory story of Turks today is similar all in at least the intelligentsia or in many parts of the country. So yes, it rings true for me. It's my favorite book of his.
For as far as tourism, when's the best time you think to visit Turkey, and can you rent a room in a pension for about 3 months?
The best time is every time, because you will see something different, unless you're going into Eastern Turkey. Because I didn't go to Eastern Turkey until recently, because I was always there when it was just too cold to go. And I'm from California, so too cold is under 60, but it gets very cold. Of course, the spring is the best time to go. Late fall or early fall can be iffy. It can rain. A pension, there are many of these old houses that have been restored on the outside and are new on the inside, or partly new on the inside, all over Anatolia and all over Istanbul, where you can rent a room. But you probably wouldn't want to stay there for 3 months. If you're going to stay for 3 months, talk to me, and I can set you up with the kinds of people that would arrange that for you.
Carol's now into tourism, too. Does anyone have any questions from the audience right now that pertains to imaging or imagining the Turkish house, about the Turkish and Ottoman houses? Because the next three questions that we have before us deal more with current events and impressions of Turkey in the current event format. And Carol and I may do these together. So are there any other questions that you may have that pertain to, yes, would you please introduce yourself, because I know you're teaching a course right now.
I'm teaching a course on Ottoman art and architecture, and part of my audience or my students are of Turkish descent, and it's very interesting for them because it's new for them almost. They have not dealt with their own past, and I just wanted to, I think that the title is Imagining is a Wonderful Title.
Oh, good, I'll tell them. Thank you. Thank you. I will tell my editor.
Thank you, Brigitte, very much. As Carol mentioned, Kemalism or secularism in Turkey from the days of Atatürk has caused a tension in society. And the question that came before us, is Turkey moving towards becoming an Islamist country where Sharia laws dominate? And this seems to be a focus in much of the media today. And obviously written by many of those who have not traveled to Turkey and had a sense of time and place and history, and especially as exemplified by the Turkish house, what the outside may look, what is happening inside, and continuity of memory. So your take on that, Carol? Is Turkey moving towards an Islamist country where Sharia laws dominate?
I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question. Things change so quickly. I think in our modern world, in the United States as well, the political ambiance is much more religious than it has ever been. And so we see that here, and we see that in Turkey we have a government for the first time that is openly religious as individuals. whether or not their desire is to have Sharia law is something only they know. It is a great fear of the most westernized intelligentsia in Turkey. I have friends who are carrying their passports in their pockets. It is not a fear of just about anyone else that I know in Turkey. My personal feeling is that many people who are quite religious or quite pious in Turkey would not vote in that direction. But these are, of course, my personal feelings.
I would expound upon that a little and say that I agree with Carol says that it's the art of living well in any life and society is really balance. And as we know, there are times in history and society where we go from one side to the other to come back to that road that what best suits the people in the country as we progress in modernity. And Carol is correct about those who were brought up in much of the Western tradition fear because that's all they've known, and not knowing that the separation of church and state as such in the French laïque sense has given an underlying tension. And what she says about those who are most pious, they would not vote for Sharia. And many of those who now have supported this AKP party, which calls itself a moderate Muslim Islamist party, in a sense, what they have seen and found is an opening of the economy and even a more westernization, because it's the AKP party and Erdogan who probably done more to push for Turkey's accession, if you will, to the European community than those who came out of perhaps a secular aspect. Yes, for some who have been brought up in this, there is a fear. And I would say probably some of them have been products of education that have come out of the American system. So it is a time of discussion, introspection, and it is not an uncommon sight to see. I was down Mahmoud Pasha one day. There's the mother in a traditional pardessus raincoat, modest. One daughter is dressed to the nines, and she has the long black raincoat piped in the red, and the red and black handbag, and the kohl eyes, and the veil, and everything, the silk veil, the heels. The other sister, she's got her jeans on, her jacket's hiked up to here. I don't think she had a tattoo, but her little shirt was all tied up, and I thought, you know, only in Turkey. Only in Turkey can you see this diversity, and this is within one family.
I'd like to add something to that. You will also see uncovered and very Western-looking mothers with covered daughters. And that speaks to another change that is happening in Turkey as well.
Yes, Frank.
I'd like to add a point or two there. I think, Carol, that you raised the question of what do we mean by westernization? What do we mean by modernization? Because the arch secularists you're referring to, the old guard who worry about Sharia, they don't necessarily represent the viewpoint of many younger associate professor level, who believe that the most important Western values are encapsulated in the phrase democracy, the free market, concepts like that, rather than ripping somebody's headscarf off. And to that, the AKP, whatever its faults, and it has faults, represents those values much better than the secularist opposition party, the JAP, which they view as embodying its own form of dictatorship, of not Sharia law, but you know, enforcement of rigid standards that they do not feel are compatible with those other Western ideas of democracy.
Frank's questions and comments referring to the westernization aspect again underlines the complexity of modern Turkish society. And I think as we move forward, it behooves us to look beyond what the media puts out there every day and take a genuine interest in what we now know as modern Turkey, where their roots have been, where are they now, what are their hopes and aspirations. And I do concur that although the AKP party has its faults as such, it has done more to open an open modern Turkey to what we call the West, the U.S., the European community, for now the Turkish people to say, do we really want to continue on this path? Or do we need to look elsewhere since there's been a rebuffing? But that's thanks to Erdogan and his vision and putting, actually dedicating a minister whose job is to look at where are they, and now we're seeing Turkey take on a new role that isn't a return to Ottomanism. It is a return to say, this is who we are in the region. These are our strengths. These are the problems in the region. These people, these countries will always be our neighbors. And how can we best keep that dialogue going with Turkey, with them, and also extend that to the rest of the world, to Europe? Turkey is a great conduit if it could be recognized and accepted in that vein for who and where they are and where they stand now. And I think my personal opinion is Sharia is really not one of the issues I see the Turkish population people dealing with. It is the betterment of their society. And no matter what outcome will happen from accession or not to the European community, Turkish society will be much better off and improved for that process and going through this process.
Do you want to? Yes, I'd like to add something that just to remind you that essentializing is always a problem. When you do go to Turkey and you meet all these Turks that you're meeting have been created by the forces that I talk about in my book. But in fact, they are people who have come from various ethnicities and religious backgrounds from all over the Ottoman Empire. As Bulgaria was becoming Bulgaria, the Turkish-speaking population moved back into Anatolia. So we have people with very, very different histories, ethnically and religiously as well, people from Georgia, people who are Sunni, people who are Shia, people who are Alevi, people who are Kurd especially, but then there are Greeks and Armenians and Jews. So when you talk about Turks, it's the same as, you know, when you go to Turkey and people ask you how Americans feel, there is a sense of what America feels, but your America and the person who lives in another neighborhood may be very different. So I want you to be sensitive to that as well.
Going back to comments Carol made, this individual said, I've never been to Istanbul. You mentioned most people would stay on the western side of the river, and how different would be one's experience to stay on the other side. And I'm wondering if that you refer to the Bosphorus, which would be east and west, or are you Harbiye and Fatih?
Well, I was referring to the Golden Horn, not the Bosphorus, because the modern hotels, starting in 1950 with a Hilton, are on the northern part. So here's the Bosphorus, and here is Turkey, you know, jutting its mare's head out of Western Asia. And so here's, and you get to Istanbul, and then you have the up northern is the Galata, Harbiye area, and then the what we call the historic peninsula that has most of the great mosques of Sinan, not all of them. The western part, as I said, goes back a long time. It goes back to the 13th century when the Genoese traders came to Byzantium and set up their little western area. So even though we call that the new area, it's not exactly brand new. But it is the area that was first westernized, and it was the area where Jews and Armenians and Greeks set up their businesses and their banks and lived. And the first place to start with the apartment buildings. It's a good place to stay, especially now because there are fabulous public transportation to take you all over from the northern part over to the historic peninsula. You will want to see that part, but you will spend your time, if you are smart, in the old section because that's where the bazaar is. And so you will want to be in the old section to see the palace, the older part of the Ottoman Empire, Topkapı Palace, the Süleymaniye Mosque, and the other mosques, and just the landscape of it. So I don't think anyone who goes to Turkey would have a different experience. However, staying in the other part is kind of nice. The lower part, the historic peninsula area near Sultan Ahmet, is mostly a youth culture. So I would stay up north in Harbiye.
And you can walk from the Harbiye area, Taksim, through İstiklal Caddesi, where really, except for the tram, there are no cars except municipal cars. But you walk down the middle of the road surrounded by extraordinary buildings. And it's just a pleasure to look up and you see the magnificent architecture, much of which is written in Orhan Pamuk's book. And as you walk down to where the tramway starts, there is the shortest tunnel that goes straight up for about 600 meters called the Tünel. It takes about 45 seconds. It does save you the walking up straight like this. And it's great fun just to take the Tünel. It's cool and refreshing on a very hot, muggy summer day. Then you can walk across the Galata Bridge to the old part, as Carol said, Sultan Ahmet area where Topkapı is. And I think it's a wonderful, the best of both worlds. We are getting our time signal here. So it looks like we really have time for only one last question. And this was actually directed to what is the work of the Turkish Cultural Foundation. The Turkish Cultural Foundation is actually a family foundation out of Boston whose purpose was to try to wade through a lot of the politics, a lot of the misrepresentations, the media, to bring the knowledge of Turkish culture to America particularly. It's headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts. We have offices in Detroit, Washington, D.C., and, of course, since I live in Sonoma, I had the Sonoma office in California. We do, there's a website called www.turkishculturalfoundation.org, which is an award-winning website that gives you every aspect of culture, music, cuisine, art, architecture, past and present, as well as the programs we run that are called People to People. One of them is a teacher study tour, and we design and give grants to, right now the main partnership is the World Affairs Council's nationwide, in which it's a three-phase grant to bring American educators to Turkey. First by the workshop on Turkey that exposes the teachers to who and what modern Turkey, from the days of the Ottoman Empire to modern Turkey. Then those who wish to partake of our tour throughout Western Turkey will apply and be accepted. And this year we're taking three. We have 20 councils nationwide, three teachers per council. Sadly, San Francisco hasn't applied since 2007, but we do have Riverside, the World Affairs Council. And those teachers will be on a 14-day tour, an extremely, I call it a rigorous cultural educational immersion tour of Turkey. And when they come back to their supporting council, they will put on a program called Portrait of Turkey. Our teacher workshops last year, the attendance nationwide was about 500 teachers, and that impacted 48,000 students nationwide in some aspect of learning in the classroom, art, architecture, culture, music, karagöz, puppets of modern Turkey. This year, as I said, we'll be taking 60 teachers in two tours. So if this is of something of interest to you, please, I left a card over there that talks about the Turkish Cultural Foundation, and you will see that it is a wealth of knowledge, particularly for those who are doing research, and links also. We have a Turkish Coalition of America that handles a lot of, I would say, more of the political. They take congressional staffers and congresspeople to Turkey, Native American Project, and as a matter of fact, we have minority scholarships, and one of which we have 100 scholarships for students of Armenian background, either from Armenia itself or Armenian Americans who wish to study in Turkey. So thank you for that question that allows me to tell a little bit of what else I do in addition to representing Turkey as their educator, advocate, and facilitator. So I thank you, our special thanks to Carol Pertram for her comments today. We also thank our audiences here as well as those listening to this recording. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 107 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.